Welcome to Planet Geo, the podcast where we talk about our amazing planet, how it works, and why it matters to you.
All right. Well, hey, my little friend, Dr. Jesse Remick, how the heck are you?
You know what? I'm good, man. I'm always excited. I'm always like inspired after these talks with people. It's a good night.
I am too.
It's a good evening.
It is a good night. I got to say, though, I'm sick of you making me so nervous before these interviews start because you give me a lot of crap. You throw a lot of shade my way for my technological difficulties, but you are on a roll,
I know,
my friend. Every time you're having technological difficulties.
Yeah, I'm like two for two with big problems here. You know what? I just need to restart my computer before every interview. It's only interviews.
Don't you restart your computer a lot, though? Like, you should. Do you not do that?
No, I don't. I rarely restart my
computer.
Do you
ever restart your phone?
When it wants to update. That's about it.
Jesse, no. You need to do this like every few days. You need to shut your phone down, restart it. Same thing with the computer. Let's go.
Yeah.
You need to do better with this. Yeah, this was I loved this interview. I learned a ton here. A large part of our conversation dealt with critical minerals and sand deposits. And those are really things that you would never, I don't think anyway, like intuitively put together, right? I certainly haven't. I don't know about you. I found it very interesting, very exciting, actually, the prospect for this.
I agree completely.
And that was amazing. Question for you. I've been teaching for, you know, a long time, right? We're not going to put a number on it.
But
I've been teaching a long time.
We don't talk numbers here.
No, we do not. Jesse, tell me, have I been mispronouncing Placer my entire career?
Placer or Placer?
Or,
how have you been saying it?
Placer, Placer. Placer, Placer. I mean, I haven't seen Placer.
No, this is like a basalt one. People say it different ways. I think it might be, you know, the Britishism of Placer, maybe a little bit.
Well, so because it's spelled Placer.
Yeah.
And to me, that's Placer.
Yeah.
That's Placer.
Just like
ALT
is asphalt. Or asphalt. That's
right. So I actually, so this came up in the interview. Okay. I said Placer and Dr. Angie Shaw right away said Placer after that. And she didn't correct me. She just said the word her way.
Yeah. Again.
And I'm like, oh crap. I've been saying it wrong all these years. I actually made a note, Jesse, down below to ask you about this because I didn't want to forget. Like, I would have been mortified if you'd have said Chris.
Yeah.
You've really been saying Placer all these years.
You know, I've heard it both ways by very good geologists. Geologists much, much better than you and I. So I think it can go with whichever one you want in the end.
Jesse, I don't give that up as easily as you do.
Well, okay.
I don't.
Okay. Well, I don't have much to say to that.
I'm just kidding.
So just a little bit of Dr. Shaw and her expertise here. She's a PhD in geophysics, really, a research geophysicist at the Geological Survey, the United States Geological Survey, the USGS, which we said. She is really an expert in these airborne geophysics data sets and has been looking at these, as we said, sort of heavy mineral sands in the coastal Carolina area in the southeast United States. She has a interesting backstory. I mean, a bachelor's in math and then actually a master's in applied mathematics from New York University. And then eventually went on, as she describes, to get a PhD because she's kind of interested in the outdoors and stuff. So I think Chris had a really interesting take on education as well. And like, I don't know, interesting perspective. That's, again, just one person's perspective, but particularly interesting and particularly unique, I think, as a path to get to where she's at a very high level in the United States Geological Survey, kind of directing large portions of this MRI program. So,
yeah, I agree, Jesse. She had a very interesting path into where she is right now. You know, she didn't start off like, oh, I have this love for geoscience. That's the direction I'm going. She came about this in kind of a very roundabout way, kind of the way I entered teaching. It was not something I was
going to. No, that's right.
It was not on my flight plan either at all.
No, that's right. Hey, well, Chris, I'd say let's get to it here. This is Dr. Angie Shaw coming at you.
Cheers.
All right. Well, Dr. All right. Shaw, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Planet Geo, and thanks for, sorry for all the technical difficulties here and getting going, but thank you for joining us. We're really excited to talk to you here on Planet Geo.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Well, hey, Dr. Shaw, is it okay if I can call you Angie, right? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Jesse doesn't allow me to do that. So I have to, I always feel like I have to ask, you know,
yeah,
just to be polite.
You still have to ask me too.
So Angie, we always start our interviews with this common question, and it's because I think both Jesse and I have a story of how, and like our path into the geoscience world and the geoscience community. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was there like this aha moment for you or something that happened that led you down this awesome pathway called the geoscience world?
Sure. Yeah. So I think my pathway is a little bit less typical. I majored in math, and I was one of those nerdy types that always really liked math and physics. And that was a comfort zone. And I struggled with things like biology where I had to memorize things. And I did a master's in it and really wasn't finding it. And so I was young and in my 20s, and I moved out from New York to the Bay Area and just realized how much I loved the outdoors. And I loved spending time looking at the mountains, looking at water. And the aha moment, I think, was when I suddenly found out that I could take all these math, I had math and computer skills, that I could take those skills and apply them to earth science, and that I could actually do the quant stuff, but also get field work where I could be out on the ocean or where I could be hiking through the woods, and I could do all this fun stuff while doing science. It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. Angie, I want to put a pin in what you said about combining your math and physics with the geology world. When we talk about getting into geology and careers, and we have a fair number of listeners that are very interested in that kind of pathway. And so I do want to make sure, Jesse, remind me, we got to come back to that.
Oh,
for
yeah,
sure.
I will. We might be fighting over that question later on, Chris, because I'm really interested in your perspective on that, Angie, because yeah. So you have a master's, is that right? A master's in applied mathematics?
Okay. I have a master's in applied math. And yeah. But that's not the final one. The later thing was the PhD in earth and environmental science. So that's what enables me to do geology.
Well, let me ask you what everybody asks all of us, you know, PhDs in geology. What does a master's in applied mathematics do? Like, what was your thesis title? And then what was your PhD thesis on? And were they like linked? This is kind of a leading, I don't know, yeah, like this is...
That's a good question, Jess.
Were they linked in a direct way? Was there a direct line to them? Or were you sort of like going out on a limb in your PhD?
Gosh, well, okay, so if you get a degree in math, what I was finding is that I was basically kind of a high-end technician there to solve other people's problems. So that was why I went back to school and said, I need to get the foundation of the science so that I can learn what's the best way to apply some sort of math or physics to a problem. So my PhD was actually very quantitative. My advisor did numerical modeling of different plate tectonic phenomena. We were actually looking at mid-ocean ridge spreading centers, and we were trying to understand how the mountain ranges that you see at the bottom of the ocean, how do they form? Why is it some of them have a valley? Why is it some of them show a mountain? How big is the mountain? Why is it that big? What are all the different characteristics? And we actually went to the laws of physics to try to understand the real processes to say, okay, what is it that's driving this? What are the forces? What are the thermal conditions? Because you've got volcanoes, you've got a certain heat distribution. So we were looking at all those technical aspects. But at the same time, I also had this opportunity to go out to sea and collect data and to do other things. Yeah, you could spend anywhere from 40 to 48 days out on the ocean in the middle of nowhere.
Holy cow.
And if you don't get seasick, then you're luckier. And if you do, there's a lot of medications. But that was, you know, and that was another thing. And I was lucky my advisor encouraged me to do this because I wasn't just doing the math and the computers, but I also got to get to see brand new data. because it's the bottom of the ocean, you have to measure things indirectly. You just can't walk there. It's not very easy. And so we would look at the magnetic fields, changes in Earth's magnetic field, changes in gravity fields. And then I was lucky, I was on one cruise where they actually did have Alvin dives. So they had geologists dive down to the bottom and look at the geology and make those observations.
And they were like grabbing samples of the seafloor with Alvin with the arms and stuff. Oh, totally cool.
That's right. Yeah.
Did you ever get to go down in one of those?
I got to go once.
Did you ever get to do
that? I did. Oh, you did an Alvin dive?
Unreal. Oh, yeah. Can you tell me about that a minute? Like, what was that like?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, so at that point, I had been studying mid-ocean ridges for, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years. And they were very mysterious to me. And yeah, it was just amazing. It was like, okay, here you are. This is what it looks like. And I think the best part about it, though, is what I saw at it. You know, it's a tiny little window. I don't remember. It's something like 8 inches in diameter, 10 inches, something like that. Then years later, I got to go to Hawaii to the Big Island where they have all the new flows. And you realize that, oh, this is like what we're seeing on the seafloor. So it was kind of cool to make that connection and realize that there are these different exotic locations, but you see the same phenomena going on. So that was kind of fun.
That is really cool.
Oh, that's super cool. Okay, Chris, I think maybe we should just dive right into the sort of education style questions real quick, because I'm curious, Angie, because at Penn State, we have some geophysicists who do numerical simulations, and, you know, the students who, PhD students who start in groups like that, usually come from different backgrounds, astrophysics or different fields that come in and have a lot of computer sort of knowledge or sort of physics knowledge, I suppose. And then I have students in my group who are like, you know, have biology degrees more or less, right? And so how did you find, because Chris and I grew up in the geosciences, like academically, right? Like we were geology majors in undergrad, learned all the terms then, but you kind of came in as a highly educated person
much
in a
later
different
on,
field,
right.
And you were kind of exposed to it later, like tangentially, how did you find, I mean, what was the most surprising thing about geology, I guess, is kind of the question. And how easy was that transition for you? Because I think we get this question a lot from listeners who are thinking, you know, I have this passion for the, kind of like yourself, outdoors or geosciences, like being a volcanologist sounds really cool, but is it too late? Could I pursue this career still? Like, what was your experience like in that regard?
I think the most important thing is to be patient. You know, I did come in with this math and computer background, and it took a bit of time to learn the geology. And it was lucky for me. No, I wouldn't say lucky. It was important for me to be in an educational institution where I had people who were willing to mentor me to help me bridge that gap. And
Did you find yourself overwhelmed with the terminology for a while? Because I'd imagine
sometimes.
I did, coming from a liberal, I went to a liberal arts college, and I went to an institution for my PhD that had is Canada. Like everybody, you know, geology majors in Canada have a ton of classes that I never took.
I think it takes a lot of time, and I think it's important to just be around it a lot and to keep talking to people. And you start to realize it's like a language. But people are talking about very specific things. And then to always be ready to learn something new, because there's always something you don't know.
Yes, that's wise advice. Yes. And remember that like everybody else doesn't know either or doesn't know different stuff. Like you have something to contribute. Your background is a strength in some ways. You know, the different, your different approach is a strength in many ways.
And I will say that I think I was fortunate that I had faculty who were willing to take a risk with someone who didn't have as strong a geology background as some others. But at the same time, I also think if you're going to switch fields, it's very important to have something you can bring to the table. That way you're still contributing something.
Right. It sounds to me, Angie, as though you found a way to marry your passion for math, and you know, geophysics is a perfect fit for that. Did that prepare you pretty well for making that transition?
It helps, but I think there's still a lot to learn. and I can say that I started off my graduate work in mid-ocean ridges, but when I was finishing my degree, I realized I wanted to do something much more applied. So I had to start from scratch again and now learn processes on the continents. And again, it was, so my postdoc, I ended up taking these gravity and magnetic methods and I applied them to Chesapeake Bay. So I was getting a little bit closer to land, but that meant I had to learn more about sedimentary geology. And we also looked at an impact crater. So I learned about impact craters. Yeah. So every time, I mean, again, you always want to have something you bring to the table, but also be ready to learn and do new things. And again, try and get mentors who are experts to help you out.
So maybe we could just finish that thread, Angie. So you, this postdoc was at the Naval Research Lab. Is that right? You went to
Naval Research.
Yeah. And then you went and worked for Raytheon, and we've interviewed other people who have a defense, who've worked in the defense industry as geologists and then have kind of come back in various ways. What was that path like, going to work for Raytheon? And then I think you started at the USGS after that. Is that correct?
Well, you know, when I went to work for them, they weren't Raytheon. They were Dynamics Technology, and they were definitely much more on the research side, and they were doing a lot of marine instrumentation. So that was a connection there. And they were looking at magnetic. One of the applications was to look for like seafloor IEDs, that sort of thing. But I'll be honest, I missed being able to do earth science, and I missed the more academic style of research. So when the USGS position opened up, I felt that was a perfect fit because the work they do is very applied, but it's also very technical and it's also research as well. So that's why when I saw that open up, I jumped on it and I was lucky to get it.
That's a perfect segue to the next thing I want to ask you about, Angie, is you work at the USGS. Can you just tell everybody what a day in the life of Angie is like? What
do you do on a day-to-day basis? Is the United States Geological Survey. Maybe we should get that term out there.
Geological survey.
Yeah.
Good point, Jess.
No, this is a good question, Chris. I'm curious about this too. I think this is probably
very important. Yeah, there's no typical day. There really isn't. It's all over the map. Well, some days it's very rare, but some days I do technical stuff and I get to catch up on the literature. Sometimes that's on the side. My own position has evolved a lot over the years. I've been there about almost 17 years. So when I started off, I did more technical work. Now I'm actually coordinating a lot more different, I'm involved with a lot more different projects. So I'm involved with coordinating different groups of people, and it started a couple years ago. We've got this Earth Mapping Resources Initiative program, which started, and that's been a huge part of life now. So there's a lot going on there. I wish I could tell. I mean, it could be anywhere from writing proposals to writing emails to trying to catch up on the literature to mentoring younger scientists on various technical things to giving podcast interviews, anything.
Yeah, I mean, the full gamut. That's perfect.
That's right.
The Earth MRI thing is super interesting. And this is actually how, I mean, I saw you give a talk at SEG, and Chris can attest to this. I went to the SEG conference in London. I'm not an economic geologist, but I was like, I had some funds from Penn State to kind of explore the critical minerals world a little bit. And so I said, okay, I'll go to London. Chris can attest to this. I was quite cranky just as a human being before that. And I came back all fired up about the critical minerals. And your talk was one of the reasons why, because it was really...
You went to see her in London, Jesse?
I didn't see it. Yeah, I did see Angie give a great talk. And it was really exciting. And I don't know, you were talking about the coastal Carolinas and the, you know, this broadly geophysical surveys looking at heavy mineral sands. And so I guess I want to talk about that specifically. Like, what is the story there? Are there heavy mineral sands in Michigan, for instance? You know, all these kind of interesting questions. But can you maybe set the stage for the critical minerals mapping, the MRI, the Earth MRI thing, just broadly first for us?
It's kind of interesting because there's starting to be more and more recognition about the importance of mineral resources, especially critical minerals. So, well, somebody once phrased it this way, everything that we use in our daily lives is either grown or mined. So that coffee mug, you can think about it, that comes from some clays. Where does glass come from? The computers have a lot much more complex array of minerals that go into them. If you've got some nice bamboo cutlery that was grown, that's a little different. But so much of what we use has to come from some material in the earth. Like I'm looking at my desk right now and, you know, I'm seeing the wood of my desk. I'm seeing my monitor. I'm seeing the mouse, the keyboard, my mug of tea, and thinking about where all these things come from. So these things have been important for a long time. But now we're talking a lot more about critical minerals. And what the definition of what a critical mineral is that this is a material that is so vital to our day-to-day lives. So you can think of something that goes into a computer or a cell phone, or goes into an advanced defense system, like rare earth elements are a good example of that. They're so important, but our supply chain is at high risk. And rare earths elements are a really good example of that because we get most of our rare earths from a single country. So that single country has a lot of control. It used to be 100%, now we're up to about 95%. So if anything doesn't go well with that country, then our economy could really be impacted. And these minerals are becoming even more important as we're thinking about climate change and we're thinking about energy transitions and looking for alternatives to fossil fuels for energy. There's interest in doing that. I won't get into the debate about it, but in order to achieve that, you do need certain materials. For example, for solar panels, the material in the glass involves rare earth elements. For wind turbines, they have super magnets in them that also come from neodymium. If you want an electric car, the battery, you need things like lithium and other materials for the battery. So there's a lot of attention coming in that direction as well. There's been a lot more recognition about the importance of critical minerals. And with that, Congress has put funding behind it. And so the big question is, well, what are our domestic resources? We don't even have very good knowledge of what they are. We don't have the most state-of-the-art data. So what can we find out? And there's a lot of different levels. You know, it happens from not only what are domestic resources, how are these things extracted? How can they be extracted safely without environmental harm or without harm to humans around, any health harm? That's a big question. How can they be processed efficiently? How can you manage the waste? So there's so many different questions. The USGS, we come in kind of at the beginning of that stage of this multifaceted effort, which is just saying, what's our domestic geology? What are the mineral resources? So that's where the funding has come in to collect data to better understand what's in our country. But now I also want to bring up one thing. It's not only for critical minerals. Along with critical minerals, we can also learn things about earthquake hazards, or we can learn about orphaned wells. We can learn about mining waste. We can learn about groundwater resources. And this comes from taking geology and applying it to so many, there's just so many different applications that are so important for our day-to-day lives. So critical minerals are really important, but natural hazards are important, water resources, and so on. So that's kind of the motivation. Okay.
Angie, a follow-up question to what you just said. Are you saying that the data that you maybe collect or other geologists collect in search of critical minerals, that data is used by other people to draw other conclusions that are important to society? Is that what you're saying, basically?
Yes. Well, that's the goal. I mean, we're in the first couple years of the data collection, so the research is really just starting to get underway. But for example, Jesse, that talk that you saw about Carolina Sands, that survey covered parts of Charleston, South Carolina. Now, Charleston was also the site of a magnitude 7 earthquake in 1886 that almost leveled the entire city. So everyone wants to know, well, where's the causative fault? And more importantly, what's the risk of another earthquake like that? Should the building codes be adjusted? How much earthquake reinforcement do you need if you live in Charleston? It's a huge question. So those same data that we used to look at heavy mineral sands, we also use them to map deep faults buried 1 to 2 kilometers or 3 or 4 kilometers beneath the earth's surface. And that informs us about earthquake hazards. So that's just one example. Wow. And there's a lot of other examples.
Yeah. So
that's a great example.
Yeah. That is a really cool one. And I want to know more about the methods. But before we get to that, I have just a more general question, because I know Chris and I have talked about this, and going through school in Michigan, and then when I moved to Canada for my PhD, but especially like the early days in undergrad and stuff, having a geology degree was sort of like, you were a little weird. You were, what are you going to do with that? People were kind of questioning, what are you going to do with your geology degree? And my sense is that right now, that's not the case. Like, I mean, just news articles. I mean, it seems like every week, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times has an article about critical minerals or about some mining. Geology is just in the news in a much bigger way. Do you?
Yeah.
Do you get that sense as well? And do you see that from your higher viewpoint in the governmental?
I think I do. Yeah, I think it is the case. I think there's a lot. Well, who knows? I don't know the reasons why. It could be there's a lot more concern about climate and about technologies. I mean, just think in the news today, there's a very large earthquake in China that did a lot of damage. It's very, kind of very tragic situation. The number of lives were lost there.
It just seems like kind of an exciting time to be, I mean, especially on going through an education system, getting a geology degree. I think it would be an exciting and promising time to be a burgeoning geologist, perhaps. And I think,
well, Jesse, that warms my heart that maybe we don't get looked at like we have a horn grown out of our head when we say we're geologists anymore. That's the right. Hope.
Well,
right?
Chris, you'll
that's
just get hope. Looked at like you've got a horn grown out of your head for other reasons. But
that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Chris, should we focus? I want to get into. Like,
I do. I want to shift directions. Can I take this?
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Sure.
All right. So, Angie, you've alluded to it, and now I want to kind of dig into this aspect of the interview, which is the work that you're doing on these critical minerals, in particular with the heavy sands. Because I think when people think about critical minerals, they don't think about looking at sand. So, tell us about this. What's going on?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you see this especially in the southeastern U.S., or really anywhere from southern New Jersey to northern Florida. If you ever walk along the beach, you'll notice sometimes some of the sands have these dark greens. And it turns out that at least in that part of the country, those dark greens actually contain minerals. They'll form these lines along the beach, kind of like you'll get a line of seaweed, and then sometimes you'll get some lines of sand. And so how do they form? So you think about how sand forms, right? So you've got rivers that will erode rocks as rivers go along rocks, and they erode the rocks and they pick up sediment and transport them. Or in a place such as Maine, sometimes you'll have waves coming and crashing right on the rocks. And as they do that, they erode sediments from the rocks. Well, this has been going on in the eastern U.S., for example, ever since the Atlantic Ocean was formed. And so those rocks are eroded by waves, sometimes by tides, sometimes by rivers, and they take all that material. Now, they also take a bunch of light sands. They get quartz. So you've got all this stuff that gets eroded, but then you keep reworking these sediments because the rivers transport them, tides move them around, waves move them around, and then you start sorting them. So I think a nice analogy is you ever take a box of Raisin Bran and then shake it up, and you notice how all the raisins are all collecting into one area? You're sorting them because the raisins are a different density from all the cereal around them. And the more you shake it, the more you're going to sort them and concentrate them. So that's how you start forming these concentrations within sand. Now, there's a couple more parts to this, but I don't know if you want to ask a question. I was going to talk about what's in those concentrations. Because of the way these minerals form, it's very important in terms of mining, but I'm going to stop.
Yeah. So I definitely do. I want to know, one, what's in the sands, and two, I think I really am curious to see how you answer, like, is there enough? Is this enough to make a dent in our critical mineral needs?
Okay. So what's in the sands? You can see these types of sand concentrations in many parts of the world. You'll see them up in Alaska, and I think there are places in Michigan too. And the content will depend on the rocks that they eroded. So now the southeastern U.S., this is an area that's has been mined for a couple decades, and it's actually actively mined. These sands are actively mined today. So the reason why there's three primary commodities that are in those sands, one is titanium, which is really important. So probably like, so I've heard a number like 70 to 80% of the white cars in the U.S., that pigment comes from titanium.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very important pigment. Yeah. And then,
hey, Jesse, look, you learned something here.
Another place?
Though? Yeah, every day.
Here's another one. You know anyone with an artificial hip or artificial knee?
I do. Actually, yeah. Yes.
Chris has four. He's got two hips. Chris has two hips and his knees that are...
Yep. So titanium, right. It's kind of inert and it's strong, and it's something, it's because it doesn't interact with the rest of our biology. That's one of the reasons people like using titanium for medical devices. They're also used for airplanes, for aircraft, for shipbuilding because of the metal. So titanium is a huge one. So there's three big ones. Zirconium is another one that's been mined a lot. That's used a lot in ceramics. So a lot of ovens, like certain types of ovens that can be heated up, that's zirconium. And then the third one, this is an interesting one, the rare earth elements. And you see those in the minerals monazite and xenotime. Now, what's curious is now, if you look at, well, where do we get our rare earth elements? Prior to 1950, we used to get most of our rare earth elements from sands. But then in the 1950s, production started to shift to the Mountain Pass, the one in California. It's a carbonatite type. And they're also shifting to China clays. These are clay hosted. So the production just moved. It was trends, the number of reasons why it switched. But now, more recently, there's a couple of companies that do heavy mineral sand mining are very interested in saying, you know, when we dig up all these sands for titanium and zirconium, we get all this monazite, and we want to process that and get the rare earths out of it. Now, it's a little bit tricky because that monazite has thorium in it. Thorium is radioactive, so it has to be handled in a certain way, and that's an issue that they're working with. But they've got stockpiles of this stuff, and so they realize, hey, we can actually make a dent on critical mineral needs. So there is a very strong interest in doing that. And that's come up just in the last couple of years, year or two, really.
Angie, that is amazing to me. Jesse, are you shocked by this? That this is
I'm still thinking
potential?
About your
like, seriously,
I'm still thinking about your hip know. Replacements that you've had, Chris, and how you still managed to walk after all the hip replacements.
You're so happy. Angie, can you please just stick up for me every once in a while? Because this guy,
I'm really pleased with that joke. Know? I thought that was quite a funny joke. Chris,
that was good. You're really happy with yourself.
Yeah, I'm very pleased.
Jesse,
with
seriously no, though, I, are no, you surprised really, by this?
I am. I have a couple follow-ups on this, Angie. So.
My okay, hold is, on. I don't want to leave this yet, though.
No,
okay. Are you changing directions?
No. It's the same theme here.
Okay.
So,
yep.
I want to. I'm guessing zirconium is in zircon. Like this, we separate
right.
zircon in mm-hmm. my lab at Penn State, and we separate monazite too. Density separate them, so like they're heavy, right? So monazite, rare earth, zirconium, probably zircon is the main source of that. Where's the titanium?
The titanium, used? Yeah. It's in the key minerals are ilmenite and rutile, and then also leucocene, which is altered ilmenite. And they're all, here's the key thing. They tend to be dark in color, but they're denser also. They're a lot denser. Yeah.
That's how they concentrate them,
and
right?
That's how they concentrate. Exactly. That's it.
Right.
So like if you can pan for it.
Yeah. No,
it's a little bit like a placer then.
Yeah, it is a placer. Kind of what... Yep.
That's
yeah.
what we
oh, placer.
Do.
Oh, yeah, placer.
Placer, placer. Tracer, okay. tracer.
My next... my follow-up to that is these minerals, at least I'm a geochronologist, so we use zircon all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so robust, and monazite's much the same, like really robust, is that a downside of mining these things? Because these minerals are just hard to dissolve. They're hard to break up, and maybe that's part of the reason why they're found in placer deposits like gold and diamonds are. Is that a downside of extracting this? Well, I guess they're already extracting zirconium out of them. So like,
I mean, yeah, I mean, getting the elements out of the minerals is something you need to work with. And I mean, rare earths is from monazite is a tricky one, but there's been some recent developments. But here's the key thing, though, is that because these are in sand, you've got two stages. One is you've got to get the minerals out of the ground. And the other one is you've got to get the elements out of the minerals, right? And what you're saying is right. Getting the elements out of the minerals, that is tricky. And I'll be honest, I don't know that stage as well.
Yeah, you're not a mine engineer or a material scientist.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. But I can say this, that getting them out of the ground is easier because it's all sand. So it's different from certain types of mining where you have to use these noxious, like you have to use, you know, cyanide and other things to get it out. Here, they get the sand and they sift it, basically. They sift it, they use these spirals, they use magnets, they use electromagnetic fields. So that's the nice part. It's easier to get the sand out of the ground. And then your tailings are a bunch of quartz sand. So you put the quartz sand back in the topsoil, you put that aside and then put that on top. Put that back when it's all done. So that's the nice part about it.
Interesting. Angie, here in Michigan, we have these kind of black stripes, as you described them too. A lot of people call them the black sands, but that's a little misleading because the beach isn't really black. It's just these really concentrated stripes. But here, if you drag a magnet through it, it's going to come loaded with magnetite sand. Is that different from what you're describing like in the Carolinas?
A little bit.
Is it a different composition?
You've got different geology. I know in Michigan, you've got some real iron rich rocks there, a lot of volcanics. So I think you're eroding a lot of basalt. The stuff you see in the Carolinas, it's a bit older. It's been around longer. And a lot of the magnetic minerals, they've been around for 100 million years and they start to alter. Some of them can be magnetic, but not as many.
Oh, that's a really interesting
point. They're not as magnetic, but they can have a little bit. They can have a little bit of magnetism.
These are really sands that have just been reworked since the opening of the Atlantic. Like these things are just...
Yeah, and then there's some new ones because even today, you know, sands are getting eroded. If you go way upstream, they get eroded by rivers. And some of the rivers, if they go all the way from the hard rock out to the coast, like the Santee River in South Carolina does that, then you can actually bring new minerals down to the coast. Also.
So, okay, in my really rudimentary understanding of like sedimentation and sediment reworking along a coastline, is all the light sand, like the quartz and stuff like that, is that all down in Florida then? Like, has the longshore current just carried that down south and all the heavy stuff stays behind closer to the Piedmont rocks?
Well,
or is that too simplistic of a way to think about it?
I do think it's a little bit more complicated than that. You're right. I mean, a lot of the quartz does get transported down to Florida, but a lot of it stays behind. And it's complicated mechanisms, you know? So when a wave... it'll pick up a whole bunch of quartz and then leave heavies behind. But then when it comes back, it'll drop a whole bunch of quartz back on the beach.
It's really complicated.
It's complicated, yeah.
Angie, a question related to this whole thing about the accumulation of these heavy sands. That's not really accessible, though, is it? Because, I mean, you're talking about beaches and that are probably already being used. And so you can't just go in and take it. So where are you talking about? Are you talking about older sands that are not on the shoreline anymore?
That's exactly it. Yeah. So no one wants to see a beach get mined, right? We just kind of want to sit and enjoy the sun and, have a nice cold beverage or something.
Yeah,
no one wants to see that. Yeah. So, but I like you talking about the beaches because it's a place where you can actually see the geology up front and close. You can look at it and you can see it. But the places that do get mined are much further inland. A lot of times it tends to be on private land. So the mining company will make an agreement with the owner. So places like Roanoke Rapids was one. There's also areas south of Richmond, Virginia that have been mined. They tend to be inland. They tend to be areas that don't have those other types of uses like recreation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm really glad that I got clarification.
Yeah.
I was struggling a little bit with the mental image.
Yeah. So Angie, how do you detect these things? And how are you leveraging your geophysics in this way? I mean, this gets complicated, I think. So we probably need to stay out of the weeds, but at a high level.
Yeah, at a high level. So I can tell you actually the first, when I first got into this, when I saw that these sands had a very weak magnetic signature and I could pick them up with a magnetometer. But then I found that really worked best if I was near a beach or if I was offshore. If you go further inland, closer to where you'd actually want to mine, it actually turns out we have methods called radiometric methods. Okay, so the way this works, remember that monazite that I talked about that has the rare earth elements in it? It's also got that thorium. So radiometric methods do is they look at elements that have some amount of radioactivity. So it could be potassium. Potassium, when it changes into argon, it releases a gamma ray. Thorium similarly releases gammas, and so does uranium. We have these sensors. They're actually made out of salt crystals, sodium iodide, I swear. And they can pick up, they can sense these gamma rays, and then they look at the energy spectrum of a gamma ray at each, every one of them. And then depending on what it is that decayed, it'll have a certain, like a footprint or a fingerprint. Maybe that's a better description. And then, so we look at those fingerprints or footprints, and from that, we back out. If I take the sensor over here, how much, is there a lot of potassium there? Or is there a lot of thorium? Is there a lot of uranium? And we can put these sensors in airplanes, and then we fly them over the area. We sort of do like a mow the lawn kind of pattern and fly over these areas. And I should mention, the footprint of the data gets pretty big when we're in an airplane. So we're talking several hundred feet for a pixel, if you will. But then we can find...
Okay, well, how high are you?
If we can do it, we'll go 300 feet to 400 feet above ground, which is pretty low. It's very, very low. If it's a more populated area, they want us at 1,000 feet. And that's just a safety consideration.
Do you get diminishing returns when you have to go that much higher?
You do. You do. Because you can think about it. We're trying to look at gammas coming out of the ground. So the further up you are, then the lower the probability that that gamma is going to hit your sensor. So it becomes a signal to noise kind of thing.
So interesting. Do you have to be in the plane?
No. In fact, I can't. I'm not supposed to be in the airplane, and I wish I could. But
why not? Why not?
Okay, so these are special airplanes. What they do is they pull
too out. Much brain power, Chris. It's just, you know, too risky.
Well, to be honest, you know.
So they would allow you on, Jesse?
Yeah. You and I could be. They'd be like, no problem. We need ballast in the back. Actually, just go stand.
Could
back
Jesse
there.
Jesse go? Sure, Chris. You can come on too. That's no problem.
I got to ask you this: how's your patience and how's your bladder? Because they're up there for 6 to 8 hours at a time, and they're just going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And the other thing is, the inside of the airplane, they rip out all the seats because you need the electronics there, you need the equipment, you need the crystals are in there, so there's nowhere to sit. And then they just go back and forth and back and forth. So the pilots, you got to admire them. It's not an easy job what they're doing. And yeah, 6 to 8 hour flights.
Now, are they contracted by the USGS
then? That's right. There are a number of companies. It's a very specialized kind of field, very specialized skill set. But they have the instrumentation, they have the right kind of airplanes, they know how to post-process the data. There's a lot of technical stuff goes into these surveys. You know, we have some of the best contractors out there.
So you're getting these gamma rays, and I must say, I just bought a gamma ray spectrometer for our lab. One of those handheld ones you can take in the field, but I don't really fundamentally understand how it works yet. We've just been kind of playing with it, a bunch of petrologists playing with a gamma ray spectrometer. But so you fly these surveys. And it's picking up, well, gamma rays that are different energies. So if I'm guessing uranium and thorium, it's picking up like different product nuclides, like somewhere in the decay chain, there's a bunch of gamma rays being released. Is that directional? Do you get like a direction if it's coming from the left side of the plane or the right side, or is it just aggregate? All the gamma rays at one time from all over are coming in.
Oh, that's an interesting question.
That pixel size.
Yeah.
Your pixel size seems small for being 1,000 feet in the air, to be honest.
We say a couple hundred meters. Well, a couple of things are happening. They are partly directional in that we have some of them are downward looking versus upward looking. And that's to correct for any radon or other things in the atmosphere. So there is that type of directionality. But what's happening is you're moving across an area and you're always aggregating what you've got. But as you're moving, the signals are changing. So with the right kind of processing, you can actually measure pretty well what the differences are. And I would say, you know, at least 300-400 feet. I usually say a couple hundred meters. It's really a normal distribution dominated by what's immediately beneath you. And I don't think we want to get into the complexities of that. But
that's pretty weedy.
But yeah.
So, well, then you follow up anything interesting with like handheld stuff on the ground, like boots on the ground measurements?
There are times,
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, we did do that. In fact, we did that up in Maine. Yeah, that was kind of interesting. I don't know if you saw this bit.
I bet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Actually, in this article, you guys, there was a big press release about, or a big article in Science on this, I think, right? Was it a
that's
Chris,
right.
We talked about this, I think, like,
yeah, we did. We did.
Yeah.
Earlier in the spring, maybe?
It was strange. Yeah, okay. We were flying over Maine and we just noticed this anomaly in this one area. It was about 800 meters by a couple hundred meters wide. Well, no, I'd say about a kilometer by 800 meters to a kilometer long and a few hundred meters wide. It picked up on a couple of flight lines. And we said, what on earth is going on here? And so we're collaborating with a professor at the University of Maine. And he said, I'm going to go look. And he went out and he brought his portable XRF, which is a way of quickly looking at chemistry of the rocks. And he said, okay, this is interesting. There's rare earth elements here. And so we said, okay. And so we went and we did kind of a multifaceted study on it. He got a bunch of samples. We did proper laboratory measurements on them. We took a handheld gamma spectrometer, exactly like what you're talking about. And then we did a walking survey much closer to the ground. Because when you're closer to the ground, then your footprint is a lot smaller. It can be just, you know, a few feet at that point. And we looked at that and looking at the samples, it turned out that the rocks were very enriched in niobium and rare earth elements. And we kind of mapped out the spatial extent of it. What we don't know is how deep it is. But the spatial...
So, yeah, this wasn't a placer, was it?
No, this is hard
rock. This was bedrock stuff.
Yeah, it's right actually on. Very fine-grained volcanic rock. So a trachyte is the name of it. And it's hard rock, and we don't know how deep it is, but the dimensions are very similar to there's a deposit in Australia, and it's a known deposit because they've drilled into it. It's similar in spatial dimensions, and it's similar. It's also very fine-grained volcanic rock. It's similar. It's got rare earths and niobium and zirconium. It's got all of those, and it's worth a lot. So we don't know if this one in Maine is worth that because we don't know how deep it is, but it's intriguing.
Yeah, that's
very interesting.
Super interesting. Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, you described beautifully the radiometric methods for your airborne geophysics, if you will. How often do you use something like LIDAR to see through the canopy as well? Because you talked about flying through Maine. I mean, Maine has a canopy of all canopies.
Yeah.
And I've seen some LIDAR and how it's used to maybe map out ancient mass wasting events and things like that. Do you use the same technology a lot?
I do, actually. Well, it depends on the method. Now, so I mentioned magnetic methods and radiometric methods. The radiometric methods measure very shallow sources, so like only a couple of feet. So if we do an overlay on LIDAR, it actually really provides us the context, the geologic context. So for example, in the Carolinas, I can see where the floodplain is, or I can see if some sands, if they're from an ancient shoreline, or if it was once more like a tidal bay or an estuary. So that's a really nice way to use the LIDAR data. If you're trying to look deeper, though, like something with magnetics, it's a little bit trickier because now you've got a separation between what's at the surface and what's down deep.
So you can kind of iterate between those three methods, kind of depending on what you're after to get an integrated view. You published this map or the surveys from Maine, right? And then, or maybe not published, but it's public
information out there.
In the Carolinas one as well. New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania, anything? Have you guys been, are you working your way up towards us or even to Michigan to go map, you know, Chris's mineral sands there?
You know?
I guess I'm asking what's next for Earth MRI? Like, what's the next couple years look like? Are you guys just cranking through loads of surveys or what's
Yes,
the-
we are cranking through loads of surveys. There are tons of surveys and I should mention all the data become public. And they're available for free. If you just Google Earth MRI acquisitions, you can see what we're up to right now. And if you click on a data set, if it's complete and the data are out there, it'll give you a link to that. So you can always find the data. Yep, we recently had a survey covering parts of Pennsylvania.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. We went, in between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. We didn't go out to the cities, but we were in the southern parts between them.
Cool.
Okay. We got the Gettysburg Basin there.
That's where I'm at right now. And I mean, my wife, I live in York, Pennsylvania part of the time. So southeast Pennsylvania, where there's like all this old iron mining, your little copper deposits everywhere, old iron furnaces and stuff like that. So kind of complicated Piedmont geology. Well, I'll be interested to see that. That'll be cool to look at once it comes out.
And I think some of my colleagues have been looking at Michigan, but I don't know that area as well.
What? All right, well, I expect you to give me a heads up on that, Andy. I want to know what's going on.
Chris wants to go on the plane as ballast. He can join along. Real quick, I'm sure this is a hard question to answer, but what are you most excited about in the next couple years? I'm sure you're excited about all of it, but is there something that's like really kind of a passion project that you're super excited about?
I don't know. I'm excited about what we're going to find next. Because I just don't know. I mean, we just keep getting these surprises. Like the stuff up in Maine, that was a surprise. You know, some of the stuff with the sands, we learned about some of the larger scale transport patterns. And I didn't know we were going to be able to do that. We got that from the potassium. That was really cool. You know, we've got a survey coming up. I'm excited about this over the Cape Fear Arch. And I want to know the Cape Fear Arch. Yeah. In between the border between North and South Carolina. And this is so interesting because, you know, we think, okay, the Atlantic Ocean opened and now everything is stable on the eastern seaboard. Nothing's moving. Well, that's not true. It turns out that there's this area close to the border between the two Carolinas that seems to be uplifting. And people know this by looking at the sedimentary history, looking at the strata, because you'd expect, if nothing was moving, you'd expect it to look like a pile of pancakes, flat pancakes. And it's not what you see. Instead, you see all these angles. And we don't understand it. There's no good explanation for it.
That's super interesting. I remember talking to a geophysicist about this, and they said that, well, a seismologist rather, and they said that there's like a piece of the lithosphere missing, that the mantle, there's like a 100 kilometer by 100 kilometer part of the mantle root. It's, I think it's a bit more north from there, but it's kind of like gone. And so they're like, oh, maybe it's related to this New England hotspot that passed through. But they use the phrase that passive margins are anything but passive was kind of the phrase, which I found really, that was a good one. I like that one. That's cool. I didn't know about the Cape Fear Arch. Is that
Cape
that
Fear?
Cape Fear Arch. Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Awesome.
Sort of like the movie, sounds, but with an arch.
Interesting. Yeah. Cape Fear. That's an oldie.
It's an oldie showing my age.
Yeah.
And one more question. I just want to circle back real quick, Angie, to the education stuff that we touched on initially. And I think your sort of advice sounded like kind of be patient, right? From your seat, you must interact with a lot of kind of industry types, academic types. You kind of bridge this divide a little bit, and especially given your interest in the applied sciences. Are there, I don't know, are there degrees that are more valuable? Like we always get, I think we as geologists sort of struggle with this innately. Volcanoes are cool, but there's only so many people who can be professional volcanologists, right? Like it's just not that many. So my opinion is if you're interested in volcanoes, go study volcanoes for a grad degree and you'll be able to use that petrology knowledge and that chemistry knowledge or that geophysics knowledge in some other field. If you don't want to be a professional volcanologist working for one of the volcano observatories or something, there's other value in that. I mean, would you agree with that? Or would you say like, hey, if you go do applied science degrees, maybe, and just as this is just from your perspective, I'm not asking you to like advise everybody, but what's the, there's a tension there, I think sometimes between like the passion driven geologists and the practical side?
Well, I don't know if it's changing. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on the individual and what it is they want to do and how happy they'll be. And some people work best in doing pure research, and they're very interested in those questions, and they're willing to tolerate all the hoops you have to go through to get a research position and to get a faculty position and to get funding, which is, it's a difficult route. It's a very competitive route, and a lot of people want to do it, and not everyone gets to do it. Even if you do have that passion, it's hard. And on the other hand, you know, maybe you're interested in geoscience, but you don't feel the need to go into pure research, and maybe you want to do something else. One thing that you mentioned is you talked about, I think you alluded to skill sets. And I think having those skill sets is really important. So I think it's important to study what you like and what you're interested in, because you'll be motivated to work really hard. But if you have skill sets that are transferable, then your opportunities expand. You'll have a lot more doors open to you, and you'll have just more options in the end. And which skill sets are helpful? I don't know. I mean, it's petrology, maybe. GIS is always a good one. Python programming is a good one. There's, you know, the skill sets that I had way back in the day, I knew Fortran. You know, no one's using that.
We still have classes that teach Fortran, and all the students are very complaining about it because they're like, why aren't we learning Python here?
I'd have the same question. I mean,
it's a completely valid question.
That was a long time ago, and I wouldn't recommend it now. So, you know, MATLAB.
All right, Angie. Angie, let's quit skirting around the issue. Mm-hmm. Here. Is it a good idea to get a geoscience degree or not? I'm going to put you on the wall.
I think it depends on the person. It depends on you, right? What are your interests? What do you want? Why are you going for it? What do you want to get out of it? And are there opportunities? I think there are. I'll be honest. I haven't looked through the ads, but I think there's a lot of opportunities. I know that for what we do for magnetics and gravity and radiometric methods, I wish there were more people graduating with that skill set.
Like the way you said that, Angie, go do something you're interested in, because you'll work hard at it and you'll be interested and you'll learn, you'll develop all those skill sets that if you aren't interested in what you're doing, you're not going to go the extra mile to kind of learn Python, because you kind of need it to solve this little niche problem in your master's or whatever. Like, I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that piece of advice and use it, because that's a good one. I think that's valuable for developing these like tangential skill sets. So anyway, okay. Well, thank you for answering that very difficult and impossible to answer question for us.
That was a winded question, Jesse.
No, it's really perfect though. It's a good, but, I mean, it's hard. It's a hard one, right? Because it's like, we all come from our own personal perspective, right? And look outwards from that viewpoint, but it's valuable. And this is something we've been trying to ask all of the people we've been interviewing recently who are, you know, successful senior scientists or senior researchers like yourself. What does it look like from your chair? Because we can only give, Chris and I can only give advice from our own perspectives. And so it's valuable. We just try and get our listeners a summary of everybody's perspective here over time. So thank you for that. We appreciate that.
If I was 20 years younger, my answer might be different. I don't know.
Yes, but you know, thankfully you're not 20 years younger, so you can give advice from a seat, a position of you know, higher level. So we appreciate that. Yeah. All right, Chris. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Take us out here?
All right, Angie. So this is I don't know. I have two favorite questions, and it's the first and the last. And I really appreciated your answer about why you got into geoscience. So now let's talk about what's been your best day as a geoscientist.
Oh, wow. There's been a few, you know. I don't know why this sticks in my head, but I think I was in my 20s, and I was doing a little solo miniature road trip in the Southwest, and it was getting near sunset, and I was looking at the horizon, and I was just looking at the mountains, and while I'm looking at them, I'm looking like, that's a half graben. You know, and it's this beautiful, beautiful sunset. And then looking at the mountains, though, I guess because I was new, I was still in graduate school. I had only been in grad school a couple of years, and I had a new appreciation for looking at mountains in a certain way and seeing the shape and then thinking about the processes that formed them. And it was something that back in the old days, I would have thought of it, oh, that's pretty. But now I thought, oh, it's very pretty, and there's a story to go with it. And I could say the same thing with looking sometimes at sands on the beach also. It's like I look at that and I'm like, oh, there's a whole story here.
That's cool. Right. I like that.
Looking at the world through a little bit of a different lens and understanding our planet. That's such a good answer. It adds so much more. It adds a connectedness, right? That's kind of what you're saying.
You know, even my aunt, she's not a geoscientist at all. She's not any kind of scientist. She learned from a friend. She said, you know, every rock has a story. And that's,
nice. I like
and
that.
It's like, that's I don't understand them, but they all have their stories.
Yes, that's a good one. Well, that is a great spot to end on. Thank you, Angie. This has been such a pleasure. I've learned a ton and I'm very interested in the sands now too. This is very exciting stuff. And I'm looking forward to seeing some geophysics from Pennsylvania too. We can investigate what's going on there. And if you need people to walk around and follow it up with a handheld gamma ray spectrometer, I guess we'll figure out how it works. We could walk down the road and point it at some rocks too.
Yeah, Angie, absolutely. I secondhand everything Jesse said, learning about the critical minerals and the sands. I don't know. I didn't know that. That's exciting that this is, you know, it's more viable than I think I ever would have imagined. And I think that's very exciting. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. And thanks for giving us your time.
Yeah,
absolutely. We really appreciate it.
We really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Angie. Hey, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. You can find all of our content on our Camp Geo mobile app. You can find all of our old podcast interviews compiled there in some sort of order. You can also find Camp Geo, our intro, our physical geology introductory course for the geosciences, audio files with images, all the images you need that we think you need to learn the basics of geology. You can also learn the geology of the Grand Canyon, geology Yellowstone National Park, and a short series on Earth's climate. All there on the Camp Geo app in the first link in your show notes. If you want to donate, subscribe, follow us, email us, or learn more about us, you can head over to our website, planetgeocast.com, and send us an email, planetgeocast@gmail.com.
Well done, Jesse. Cheers.
Thank you.